Hello there, and welcome to the third instalment of the Quegg's Debating Society podcast. Thank you very much for tuning in again, against all the odds.
Thank you very much for coming back, and yes, and today's debate, as promised, will be about whether or not Shamama Begum, who ran away 5 years ago to join ISIS, should be allowed to return to the UK. Now, this debate comes hot off the press of the court ruling, which said that she should indeed be allowed to come back to contest the stripping of her citizenship.
Indeed. Now, we do want to offer a rather big disclaimer to this debate, saying that what our debaters are about to say is not necessarily what they themselves, deep down in their heart of hearts, believe. All four of our debaters agreed to debate, and only after that point were they randomly allocated our aside. They might not agree with what they're saying, but they're saying it in the interests of a good, interesting, two-sided debate and for the sake of playing devil's advocate. I promise you that none of the debaters are racist fascists, and I hope that it never comes across like that as well.
So, just to welcome our sides for the proposition, i.e. saying that she should be allowed to return to the UK, we have Jacob himself and we have Grace. And for the opposition, who are saying that she should not be allowed to return to the UK, we have Fran and Lydia. Now, let's welcome our first speaker for the proposition. Please welcome Jacob.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, this House resolutely believes that Shamama Begum should be allowed to return to the UK to live. And we have five main points, and they fall into three categories. The first of which is about citizenship. It was illegal to revoke Shamama Begum's citizenship. I'll explain why. And it was also discriminatory, and Grace will explain why. Our next point is about the UK's responsibilities and obligations. Grace will argue that shutting the door on Shamama Begum is irresponsible, and I'll argue that she needs to be put through our justice system. And our final point, which Grace will also mention, is the fact that Shamama Begum was a 15-year-old girl who was groomed into joining a terrorist organisation. Starting, though, with the fact that her citizenship was stripped. It's illegal, against the law, forbidden. It's, I don't have any more ways to describe it, but it is just wrong. And I'll tell you why. Article 15 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights of 1948, to which the UK is subscribed, affirms that everyone has a right to a nationality. And damn right. Because if you don't have a nationality, you're a citizen of nowhere. There is nowhere in the world that you can call home, that is a refuge for you. Nowhere where you are not illegal. So revoking Begum's citizenship was in contravention of Article 15 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights of 1948. Members of the 1954 Convention relating to the status of stateless persons, to which again the UK is subscribed, which says that someone is stateless if they are, quote, not considered as a national by any state under the operation of its law. Well, Shamama Begum, without her British citizenship, is not considered as a national by any state under the operation of its law. So, according to the 1954 Convention relating to the status of stateless persons, it was illegal. And then there's also the 1981 British Nationality Act, which also states that her citizenship can't be stripped. Of course, this is important because the only reason she can't come back to the UK is because her citizenship was stripped. Now, there are some people who say that she either has Bangladeshi citizenship or is eligible for Bangladeshi citizenship. But that quite simply is not true. It's not true. In February 2019, Abdul Momen from the Bangladeshi Ministry of Foreign Affairs itself said that Begum was not a Bangladeshi citizen. There was, quote, no question of her being allowed into the country, and, quote, in no way is she Bangladesh's problem. That's as clear as it gets. Actually, using the nationality of her parents to treat her differently under the law, well, that, my friends, is discrimination. And that's something that Grace is going to talk about momentarily. I also believe that Shamima Begum should be allowed back to the UK so that she can be put through our justice system. Sajid Javid, the Home Secretary, who actually illegally revoked her citizenship, said, "If you back terror, there must be consequences." And indeed, I agree with our good friend Sajid, there must be consequences, but I believe those consequences should and must and can only be decided by a process of justice. Indeed, Tasmin Akunji, the Begum family lawyer, said she committed a criminal offence to join a terrorist organisation. A criminal accusation should be levied at her, evidence should be brought, a jury of her peers should listen to the evidence and find her guilty or innocent. That's how we deal with anyone when we accuse them of crime. And it does beg the question, when we were fighting against ISIS, what were we fighting for? The answer, of course, is our Western way of life and our so-called British values. And fundamental to that Western way of life and those so-called British values are the rule of law and universal human rights. That is to say that everyone has the right to a fair trial, including Shamima Begum. And according to the law, everyone has the right to have a state, and that includes Shamima Begum. Now, I can absolutely understand what the opposition will no doubt say, that she poses a national security threat. And I don't want to minimise that point. I'm not talking about welcoming her at Heathrow with a mariachi band and a free ticket to Blackpool Pleasure Beach. Not at all. There are temporary exclusion orders which basically bar British citizens from coming home until and unless they agree to investigation, monitoring, and if required, de-radicalisation. So if you want, let's use a temporary exclusion order. We could also charge her under the Terrorism Act 2000, under Section 5 of the Terrorism Act 2006, under the Serious Crime Act 2015. We could pass the Counter-Terrorism and Border Security Bill and charge her under that as well. And indeed, there is precedent. Tarina Shakil from Burton-upon-Trent is another British jihadi bride who got out of a war zone, returned home, and was subsequently jailed for 6 years for membership of a terrorist group. But I do want to say, I'm unconvinced that that is necessarily the right approach. On the one hand, we have the arguments about her being still a national security threat, in which case what I'm saying is that we can deal with it. Our justice system is designed to deal with it. On the other hand, I think there's a very legitimate argument to say that Shamima Begum was a 15-year-old who was a victim of grooming and who needs, more than anything else, rehabilitation. And that's a point that Grace is going to come on to. But in short, we need to give Shamima Begum her citizenship back because it was illegal to take it from her in the first place. And we need to put her through our justice system because then justice will be done and we need not worry because our national security will be protected. So this House does believe, quite strongly in fact, that Shamima Begum should be allowed to return to the UK to live. Oh my, Jacob, thank you for that brilliant, wonderful, informative speech.
Apparently.
Next up, and the first speaker for the opposition, we have Fran.
Right, thank you. So, me and Lydia both believe that Shamima Begum should not be allowed back in the UK. And Jacob repeatedly mentioned the legality of it. So, he started with the 1981 British Nationality Act. But in 2014, there was a change to Section 40 of it that states the Home Secretary can cancel the citizenship of a single nationality holder even at the risk of creating statelessness, if the Home Secretary believed the person being stripped of their nationality could require one. It was tailored to fit the UK's obligations under international law and can only take place for conduct that was deemed prejudicial to national interests. And Shamima Begum does have citizenship. Under the Bangladeshi bloodline law, she is automatically a citizen of Bangladesh because her mother was a native. So this is backed up by some expert lawyers in Bangladeshi citizenship cases who have told the BBC that under Bangladesh law, a UK national like Miss Begum, being born to a native Bangladeshi citizen, is automatically a Bangladeshi citizen. She doesn't need to apply for a citizenship. She automatically has one. Her Bangladeshi citizenship is existent, but it's dormant. And you have until you're 21 to apply to retain that citizenship. And I stress the word retain because that proves that she already has it. She just has to apply to keep it. And seeing as Mrs. Begum is not 21 yet, she still has her Bangladeshi citizenship, which I think proves the Home Secretary saw that there was a legality to it be able to revoke her British citizenship because she doesn't even need to acquire another citizenship because she already has one. Jacob also mentioned Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which I have here. And as I've just proven before, she's not stateless. So Article 15 isn't being broken, but seeing as Jacob mentioned the Universal Declarations of Human Rights, let's have a look at some of the ones she's broken. So just a few that stand out to me are Article 3, everyone has the right to life. Article 5, no one should be subjected to torture. Article 18, everyone has the right to freedom of thought, conscience and religion. Article 19, everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression. So I think when Jacob's trying to justify wrongly that the British government has broken the human right obligation to Shamima Begum, that's not true. But he's totally ignoring the fact that she joined a terrorist organisation that has blatantly just ignored all human right articles out there, which is just wrong. Jacob also mentioned the 1954 Convention relating to the status of stateless persons, which I also have here. Now, he says she's protected by it, but under Article 1, it tells you who this convention does not apply to. So this convention should not apply to people who have committed a crime against peace, a war crime, or a crime against humanity. Now, just looking specifically at one of them, a crime against humanity, there's 11 different types. Murder, enslavement, torture, imprisonment, personal, political, religious, racial, or gender grounds. There are just a few. There's also extermination. And if you really want an example, the genocide of the Yazidi race in Iraq is just one of the many tragedies ISIS have committed. It also doesn't protect people who are guilty of acts contrary to the purposes and principles of the United Nations. Let's have a look at some of those principles. The maintenance of international peace and security. I don't think you can say a terrorist organisation does that. Development of friendly relations among states. I think if you look at what ISIS are doing, invading Iraq and Syria to build a caliphate, you can't say they're trying to be friendly towards states. So she is in conclusion there, when we look at legality, Shamima Begum has Bangladeshi citizenship. So Jacob's point about it all being illegal is completely wrong. No Universal Declarations of Human Rights articles were broke. She's not protected by the 1954 Convention on the State of Stateless People, one, because she's not a stateless person, but if Jacob really says she is, well, she's not even protected by it. So next, let's have a look at the justice system. So Jacob said she could come home and be prosecuted and it'd be some form of justice. Well, only one in 10 jihadis that have come back to Britain find themselves in court. And I think, yeah, there's some argument that maybe Shamima Begum because she's in the public eye, they definitely have to prosecute her for the things she's done. But you've got the problem of trying to find evidence, rock hard evidence, to send her to jail for a very long time. And because women in ISIS have a far less publicized role, that's going to be very hard. And that will result in a lack of evidence and probably a short sentence. There's also problems with de-radicalization programs. A 2018 or 19 Home Office investigation found that 95% of de-radicalization programs don't work. For example, look at Usman Khan. He completed 2 de-radicalization programs when he served half of his 16-year service. And when he got out of jail, he was responsible for the London Bridge attacks. There's also the argument with prosecuting Shamima Begum that women generally are sexistly ascribed emotional tendencies. So research suggests that women are treated more leniently in court because they are, and I quote, duped or forced into terrorism, meaning they are given less de-radicalization support and security monitoring. So one example of this is Farhana Begum Ahmed, when in 2018, she was saved from prison by giving a 2-year suspended sentence after she had joined Facebook, joined an Islamic group chat, and had approved the ISIS Paris attacks, and wrote posts that directly encouraged others to launch terrorist attacks. She'd also been to Syria with her husband and children and returned to the UK, leaving her husband still fighting in Syria. But her lawyer argued that she was, quote, a good mother who was led astray. And in the judge's final speech, he said, quote, you have devoted your life, apart from this abhorrent behaviour, to the care of your children. I think encouraging terrorist attacks on our street is more than abhorrent. You know, this woman took her children from schools and their life in Britain out to Syria, and I don't think you can say that that's fair and that's justice. And these are the problems that we will face if Shamima Begum comes back to our justice system. Okay, one of the next things that Jacob brought up was that Shamima Begum, playing on her age, she was a 15-year-old girl, groomed. It's not her fault. She's a victim. And I think at the time, back in 2015 when she left, that was the general consensus about her. But the truth is, our knowledge about jihadi brides' roles in ISIS and just the general consensus has changed about the roles jihadi brides play. For instance, there was a report released by the United Nations by a part of the Security Council only in 2019, warning about failing for the jihadi bride stereotypes because they are causing female ISIS members to be underestimated by security services. They said that the gendered assumption that women lack agency can have serious security implications by letting dangerous actors slip through the cracks. And let's not forget that Shamima Begum has slipped through the cracks before. Just before she went out to ISIS, security services came and interviewed her at her school when one of her friends left for Syria, and she was deemed not a threat. And you think now, after 5 years being completely submerged in ISIS ideology and of being trained to perfection about how to lie and how to get past security services, she will be a bigger threat than she was 5 years ago. And let's also not forget, it was a female who recruited Shamima Begum in the first place, a Scottish student called Uksa Mahmood. So we can't fall for this stereotype anymore that these 15-year-old girls are victims. They chose their life. You can't underestimate how much willpower and complete infatuation with ISIS it takes to leave your life, your friends, your family, to board a plane to Syria on your sister's passport, board a plane to Turkey, cross from Turkey to Syria, offer to marry a man 12 years your senior, and devote your life to having his children and just listening to whatever ISIS wants to do. You know, that is not a mean feat, and it's naive to think that it takes just a little bit of naivety on Shamima Begum's behalf to have her completely groomed, because it wasn't groomed. She went of her own free will. There's people pushing her in a direction, but you have got to have a strong belief and willpower to want to go and do that. The report also said women play important roles in ISIS recruitment and propaganda activities. Even if they do not fight, they can still spread radical ideas and encourage others to commit attacks. And just looking at encouraging others to commit attacks, I said before in the legal statement, there was that lady who was sentenced to a 2-year suspended sentence for encouraging others to commit attacks. When we look at Uksa Mahmood, she recruited Shamima Begum, and there's far more other women who are huge, very, very important to ISIS, and Shamima Begum is one of them. I'm gonna try and guise what Grace is gonna talk about, which Jacob said was the discriminatory citizenship. And I think what Grace is gonna try and say here is that it creates a two-tier citizenship class that's built on race. And I just want to say, I agree with that. I think that's what's going to happen. I think that is discriminatory, and I think that needs to change. But the way that it should change is not by protecting Shamima Begum by amending the law. I think the law should change in other ways that stops protecting British people with straight lineage. And I hope that makes sense when Grace talks about it. You know, you can look back. And I think Grace is also going to talk about the irresponsibility that we've just left Shamima Begum in Syria. You know, we're just trying to get an easy way out. When that's not the case, we are being responsible by not letting her back into our country. That is a responsibility. We have seen that she's a threat, and we're not going to let her back. She made her choice. She went to Syria. Why should we protect her? It doesn't make sense. So I think what it all comes down to about Shamima Begum's return to live in the UK, it's a multifaceted decision, no doubt, but some factors must be considered more important. And the legality of it is without doubt the most important, because if revoking her citizenship was legal, which it isn't, then she'd be let back into the UK regardless. And I think, of course, there's always going to be different interpretations of the law, as you've seen with me and Jacob. However, the Bangladeshi bloodline law, where Begum automatically has an existent but dormant citizenship through her mother, is incredibly compelling. The next comes national security. The MI6 have came out and said that they believe she is a threat. That's not a political statement. That is a telling declaration by the main anti-terrorism organisation in Britain, saying that the British population is at risk by the return of Shamima Begum. Like, how can you dismiss that when that is being said? You can't turn a blind eye to something like that. Next, we've got to think about precedent. Revoking Begum's citizenship is not an aberration. She was one of 104 others in 2017 whose citizenship was revoked, implying this was not a targeted attack against a 15-year-old girl because she's in the public eye. You can't underestimate, and I don't think we can fully comprehend right now, what the consequences could be of reinstating Begum's citizenship. This would dramatically increase the likelihood of other ex-jihadi brides and terrorists being able to make a far stronger case about having their citizenship reinstated. And then they'd just be allowed to be let back into our communities. And statistics have shown that Britain is the most magnanimous country in terms of their return rate of ex-terrorists back in regards to Europe. So, for example, a 2018 study by King's College London found that the return rate of ex-terrorists back to Britain was 50%, compared to France, that was just 12%. And by 2019, Britain had let the most people back, ex-terrorists back into their country. And this shows that Britain has forgiveness. It forgives people, but on a case-by-case basis, when you look at national security risks, de-radicalisation processes and so on, and Shamima Begum does not pass that case. Lastly, we have morality, and this factor has to be viewed minimally in regards to Shamima Begum's case, because at the end of the day, Shamima Begum left her life in Britain to go and join a terrorist organisation whose aim is to spread fear through our streets and kill our loved ones. And morality can only go so far in this situation. And plus, if we're going to forgive terrorists, some of the most evil human beings in the world, who can we not forgive? Some things just don't deserve forgiveness. Shamima Begum has even said that she doesn't regret joining ISIS. So why would we forgive someone who doesn't regret the horrors she has been a part of? Shamima Begum's morals are completely antithetical to the morals that Britain uphold. Therefore, why are we going to bend over backwards for someone who isn't repentant in the first place? We have a UN report, along with Dutch authorities and the MI6, saying jihadi brides are underestimated. So there was the UN report released by the Security Council. It was the MI6 saying they believe she's a threat. And they have the Dutch authorities saying that jihadi brides are underestimated because of their exposure to ISIS ideology. We also have a rare bipartisanship among the Conservative government and Labour Party, who are both opposing the return of Shamima Begum. Labour have said that, and I quote, "We will not let anyone back who wishes us harm." You can't get a bigger international organisation than the United Nations. You can't get a bigger British anti-terrorism network than MI6. You can't get bigger political figures than the government and the leader of the opposition. So if they're all together, how can you ignore the reports and statements and stances made by them? Shamima Begum felt so strongly about ISIS that she dedicated leaving her life. And as I've said before, she left her friends, her family, to marry a man 12 years older than her and devote her life. Because let's be honest, when she was going to Syria, she wasn't thinking about coming back. Are we just supposed to look very narrowly at the Shamima sob story and forget all the horrors she's been a part of? Lastly, I'd just like to pose a question to everyone listening. So, do you think that if the caliphate was still strong in Syria, she still had a husband to protect her and she still had a roof over her head, Shamima Begum would be begging to return to the UK? Because if your answer isn't instantly yes, then I think this strongly implies that you aren't deceived by her pleas. Shamima Begum only wants to return to the UK because she has no other option, not because she wants to. And I think if you think that through, you will realise that Shamima Begum should not be allowed to return to the UK.
Thank you very much for that brilliant speech there, Fran. Now let's welcome our second speaker for the proposition. Please welcome Grace.
Firstly, before I start with my points, I'd like to reference something that Fran said in her speech. She said that Shamima Begum had dormant Bangladeshi citizenship. I'd like to say that that's actually false. She doesn't have dormant Bangladeshi citizenship. There's a British Bangladeshi barrister and part-time tribunal judge who's reviewed Bangladeshi citizenship laws, he came to the conclusion that Shamima Begum was not a Bangladeshi citizen, unless at the time of her birth, her parents had registered her at the High Commission. And he says that this was very uncommon within the British Bangladeshi community. And Begum's family has confirmed that she didn't do that. So Shamima Begum is not a Bangladeshi citizen. Furthermore, even if she was to apply for Bangladeshi citizenship, she wouldn't get it, even though, you know, she might have an entitlement to it. The Abdul Momen from the Bangladeshi Ministry of Foreign Affairs said that she was not a Bangladeshi citizen, and that there was no question of her being allowed into the country, and in no way is she Bangladesh's problem. Therefore, she can't be a Bangladeshi citizen. So stripping her of her British citizenship is making her stateless. That's what I just wanted to say before we got into that, to just get rid of the lies in what Fran just said, I suppose, to confirm the truth. And now getting into what I was going to say. So Shamima Begum was born on British soil. She's a British citizen with parents who were immigrants. Stripping her of her citizenship and refusing to allow her to live in the UK could leave descendants of immigrants on very shaky ground regarding their citizenship. At what point does their citizenship being revoked stop being a threat to them? It seems that the government's decided that they could strip Shamima Begum of hers just because her parents were immigrants, regardless of whether she herself had any connection to her parents' homeland or any entitlement to that citizenship at all. The citizenship of children born in the UK should not be conditional upon anything. They are British, full stop, and so is Shamima Begum. But this government apparently doesn't see it that way. At what point does someone become British enough to this government to not have their citizenship held over them like a threat? Is it when their grandparents were immigrants? Or their great-grandparents? Where does it stop? If the government is successful in revoking Shamima Begum's citizenship, it raises serious questions about this government's treatment of immigrants that should not be ignored or explained away. No matter what Shamima Begum's actions were, she was still born and raised in Britain, and stripping her of her citizenship feels reactionary and unconsidered. It's frankly dangerous. And I can tell you exactly why it feels so reactionary. When Shamima Begum left the UK for Syria, she was 15 and groomed into joining ISIL. I'm a 16-year-old girl, and so being quite close in age to her, I can see that this wasn't a choice that was made in a mature or considered manner. You know, they rarely are. Girls my age, we definitely don't have our heads screwed on right most of the time. So it is incredibly easy for somebody to take advantage of that. That and the typical feeling, the teenage feeling that nobody understands you. It isn't hard to see that somebody acting maliciously could capitalize on that emotion to radicalize young teenage girls. I'd argue that, unlike what Fran said, this wasn't a choice she made fully knowing everything that it was going to do for her. Being manipulated into something like this is quite similar to being groomed in the conventional manner, except victims of conventional grooming aren't demonized the way these girls were. This grooming happened on British soil and targeted British citizens. The government's reaction should not be to point the blame elsewhere and act like three 15-year-old girls were fully cognizant of the choice they made. These were young girls. The brain doesn't fully stop developing until your mid-20s. Do you really think that they understood the sort of conditions they'd be enduring in ISIL camps, or the things they would have to see and do in the name of this terrorist organisation? They couldn't have. And for that reason, I feel that their being groomed should be fully taken into account when considering this case. Shamima Begum made a choice as a 15-year-old girl that people are still holding her by today. I'm sure you've seen people saying it was her choice, she chose to go, but that isn't what we should be saying. We should be acknowledging that she was groomed and that now she might be beginning to change her mind and realizing that that environment is not a good place to be in. She wants to return to the UK now. She's in a dangerous location. For that reason, I think she should be brought back to the UK. And if she faces trial for her actions as part of ISIL, it should, as Jacobs clarified, be the UK that charges her and deals with her. Another reason that I think she should be allowed to return is that ultimately her radicalisation was in part due to failure by British authorities. Fran touched on this. Shamima Begum and her friends slipped through the gaps in the system in a way that nobody should have allowed them to. Her family's lawyer revealed that she and six friends were questioned by police regarding another school friend travelling to join ISIL 2 months before. But their families were never informed. They were never told that their daughters were potentially at risk for being radicalized. Without being told, how could they prevent their daughter's radicalization in a crucial time like this? Perhaps if they had been informed, they could have prevented them from leaving. They could have kept a closer eye. As close friends of a girl who had been radicalized, who went to the same school as them, Shamima Begum and her friends should have had access to a rigorous support system. But where was it? The authorities in this case seemingly did not care at the time. And when this issue was raised to Tower Hamlets Council recently, they said that this failure did not meet the threshold for a serious case review. The radicalization of three girls and the deaths of two of those three were a result of their negligence, and it still doesn't meet the threshold for a serious case review. What will have to be done for the UK authorities to admit that their failure to act played a role in Shamima Begum's actions? It was only after she and her friends left that there was support laid out for their four remaining friends at Bethnal Green Academy, making them wards of the court, and this was far too late. You shouldn't have to lose four girls to radicalisation to even begin to address the issue. This was a shocking failure, and one the British government needs to take accountability for. If we don't bring Shamima Begum back, we have no way to address these issues. This attempt to prevent her from returning is a shirking of responsibility because the authorities don't want to admit their negligence. If we don't acknowledge that Shamima Begum's radicalisation was a British issue and the result of a British failure, we can't try and solve the enormous issue her radicalisation exposed. This is a really important thing to get right if it means that further radicalisation of youths can be prevented. Perhaps there could be a protocol to deal with potential radicalisation that wouldn't allow for this sort of slipping through the gaps on this scale. We have to take accountability in this situation, and that can only be done if we force a serious review of the events that occurred and anything that could have been done to prevent this. But for any of this to happen, Shamima Begum needs to be brought back to the UK. This can't be done from afar. She needs to be brought back so that this issue can be acknowledged and so that we can work on it to try and improve it in the future to prevent radicalisation and to prevent damage and risk to other young girls. Because we shouldn't allow this to happen again. But the British government is allowing it to happen again if they don't bring her back and force a review. And for those reasons, I think that Shamima Begum needs to be brought back to the UK. Thank you.
Thank you, Grace, for that speech. And now we will move triumphantly on to Lydia, the final speaker for the opposition. Please welcome Lydia.
Fran made some excellent points on our team's behalf, and I'm just mainly going to focus on replying to what Grace said. So Grace has talked about the issue with the government revoking Shamima Begum's citizenship. Really, though, if we look at the Bangladeshi bloodline law, she is a citizen of Bangladesh. I mean, yes, there's lawyers and government saying certain things, but essentially it's at the point where no one wants to take responsibility for her. Fran and I feel that she has got a dormant citizenship, and it's simply that Bangladesh don't want to accept that. We feel that she does have dual nationality, and the UK government can therefore revoke citizenship on reasonable belief that she is a citizen of another country. So as far as the vast majority of the public and the government and people have looked into it say, she is a Bangladeshi citizen. Now, I just want to move on to Grace saying how hard it must be for her having parents of a different nationality. But the thing to remember is that her own family have said they agree with the decision. Begum's father has said that he does not have a problem with the government's decision to remove her British citizenship. And he condemned her lack of remorse for joining ISIS. Her father has said that she is stuck in a Syrian detention camp because of her own actions, and he has said he is on the side of the UK government. He said he doesn't know if it's the right decision or the wrong decision. But if the lawmakers of the land say it is correct to cancel her citizenship, then I agree, is what he said. So now if we move on to the issue of Shamima Begum being a minor. At first I felt, as I'm sure many of you would, that she was a victim because she was groomed into joining ISIS. However, she has said as an adult that she understood what she was doing at the time and that she doesn't regret her decision to come. How can we accept someone back into our society who, as an adult, has said they did the right thing by joining a terrorist organisation? I was wondering when she went. She's become an adult, and since becoming an adult, she's choosing to carry on living there. So a lot of her decisions have been made as an adult. The atrocities she has committed, such as sewing ISIS terrorists into suicide bomber vests so that if they try and remove it, it detonates. She's been described as being a harsh enforcer of ISIS rules and laws, and Grace has said that it was bad that the parents weren't made aware of the fact their daughter was at risk. But however, when we think about it, everything was very much in the media at the time. So did the parents actually need to be made aware? Because they would be aware. There is no way they couldn't be. We don't really know the ins and outs of how the school dealt with the situation. But the parents will have known that a child from school ran away to join ISIS, as, well, more or less the whole country did. Now, if someone in your group had run away to join ISIS and your parents heard on the news, they're going to be concerned. They don't need the authorities telling them to be concerned. They are already going to be. So now we move on to the fact of, are we rejecting our responsibility by not letting her come back? I understand what you're saying. We should be the ones to deal with what she's done, to put her to justice, to help her turn her life around. But it'd be dangerous to us for her to come back to live in the UK. The UK has a population of 67 million people. So we are putting a lot of people at risk for the sake of one person. It's been thought that the cost of her lifetime imprisonment and keeping her safe, because let's face it, we need to keep her safe as well, that this would be about £10 million. That's a lot of money. And of course, some of you will think she's changed, that she's not a threat. But there is evidence that she could still be a threat to the public. Currently, she's in the Al Hol refugee camp. And I read a Washington Post article which reported that the Kurdish security officials affiliated with the Syrian Democratic Forces said of the women at the camp, "We can contain the women, but we can't control their ideology." And it seems there's many people at the camp who are still holding an ISIS-enforced ideology because it's become so ingrained on them. Now, the spaces in the camp that are like an academy, it was said, children born into the camps, there was reports of them drawing ISIS flags, making toy weaponry. But they're being taught by the people in the camp that this is the right thing to do because the security officials just can't control what's going on. We don't know if she is still a part of it, but she has justified various terrorist attacks, including the Manchester Arena bombings. Furthermore, if she's been living in Syria for the past 5 years, that's a quarter of her lifetime. How are we supposed to undo all that radicalisation? And as Grace said, your brain is still developing at that age. So if those 5 years during which her brain was developing were spent living under ISIS law and the ISIS ideals and this terrorist message, will this be ingrained in her brain for the rest of her life? How are we supposed to undo that? De-radicalisation programs are not thought to be working. A 2018 report done by the Home Office found that 95% of de-radicalisation programmes are failing. So why would we presume it would work with her? So really, should she be allowed back? The decision creates precedent. if she's allowed back, then perhaps all the other people who've joined ISIS are going to use that as an argument for them being allowed back. She doesn't regret her decision. She's living in a place that's renowned for still enforcing ISIS law. When you watch interviews of her, she shows no emotion, no remorse. I do not think that we can justify letting her live in the UK and putting one person's security above that of 67 million others. Thank you.
So thank you very much there to Lydia, and thank you to all four of our speakers who took part today.
Yes, thank you very much for tuning in, and we hope you enjoyed it. And we remind you that you can actually take part by voting. Last debate, the result was 55% to 45% in favour of a proposition. So that was James and Joshua arguing that vaccinations should be compulsory. This time, if you go to the website Slido, so that's www.sli.do, and enter the special code 77614, so that's sli.do and the code 77614, you'll be able to vote for which side you think debated better, and we'll share the results in the next episode.
Indeed, and so please do tune in next time for our debate on whether or not GCSE exams are fit for purpose.
See you then. In the meantime, stay safe.